Hall of Fame Chicago Bears coach Mike Ditka yesterday sounded off on concussions in the NFL.
The responsibility falls on the National Football League, and it always will. My dad told me a long time ago, you got obligations and responsibilities in life to do the right thing. It's time that they did the right thing.
We speak with WBEZ's Michael Puente, who was at that Chicago luncheon. Nuclear power company Exelon is looking to support one of its rivals in coal. We'll find out more. We also talked to Woodrow Wilson fellow Michelle Egan about the implications of Brexit for the U.S. and Illinois.
Will London still remain the center of the financial relationship within the EU? What will Britain be post-Brexit?
All that plus a conversation with Central Illinois photographer Larry Camphor about his new work, A Prairie State of Mind. Lots coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Nuclear and coal, you'd think, would make for strange bedfellows, but Chicago-based Exelon, this nation's largest nuclear power company, is working on a deal that would help improve its own revenue and also improve the fortunes of Dynegy, the second largest power generator in the state, which operates several coal-burning power stations. Exelon's proposal that was first floated in June would give Dynegy and other downstate power producers consistent and likely higher revenue, but it would mean that businesses and households would be paying more for electricity. Joining us on the phone to explain all of this from Chicago is Steve Daniels. He wrote about this for Crane Chicago Business, where he's a senior reporter. Hey, Steve, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Can you remind us what is Exelon proposing?
Yeah, they're proposing, it gets a little obscure, but the way that the power markets work is that there are two prices that consumer households and businesses pay for power. It's all embedded in one price. One is the actual price of the power itself, which fluctuates in the markets, and the other one is a price that they pay to ensure that certain plants are available during the highest demand periods of the year. So it's kind of like a reservation or insurance policy. Those are called capacity prices. And in downstate Illinois, the way those prices are set, they're lower than they are up here in the Chicago area. So it makes it more difficult for power plants in a low wholesale price environment to be profitable. So the proposal would have the state step in instead of a regional grid manager to acquire that capacity and do it at a higher price that would help those plants earn money and help more of them stay open. There's already three Dynegy coal-fired power plants that Dynegy has said it will close.
And I want to get also to the nuclear plants that might be closing, but I want to ask you, how unusual is it for a nuclear power company to be trying to help out a coal power company?
In this case, it's very unusual because the two have been engaging in a public war of words for months over Exelon, which is the nuclear company attempting to win subsidies for nuclear plants, and it has predicated its argument for those subsidies on the fact that nuclear plants do not emit carbon, whereas coal-fired plants, of course, are a major source of carbon, and which contributes to climate change and global warming. So, Exelon has had very pointed things to say about Dynegy and the pollution that its plants emit, and so then to then sort of turn around, come up with a sort of behind-the-scenes proposal that would help more coal plants stay open is definitely interesting.
And how skeptical are people inside and outside of the industry about what Exelon's intentions are in this sudden public support for Dynegy?
Well, I mean, I think it's fairly clear what's motivating them. It's not because they have changed their minds about all of this. I mean, I think if they thought they could get a comprehensive energy bill in Illinois passed and also box out the coal industry, they'd be happy to do it. I think they've concluded it's politically impossible to do that, that they're going to need downstate votes in order to, because, you know, a lot of the stuff in that energy bill is controversial. It's not just the nuclear subsidies. There's all kinds of other things in there. It's a tough sell regardless. So I think they just concluded they needed Dynegy support to make it happen.
And what do you think that if you have both of these companies together, what is the, I wonder what you think that their combined lobbying power would be within the state legislature to get what they're asking for?
Well, Exelon is in energy politics. Exelon and Commonwealth Edison, which is a unit of Exelon, are by far the most powerful players in the state. They contribute an awful lot to political campaigns and have over the years demonstrated their clout in Springfield. Dynegy, not as much, but Dynegy, you know, both companies have the support of unions. That they both have unionized workforces. Unions are obviously important constituents with the Democratic Party, which dominates the legislature. So, yeah, both together are formidable, no question. But there are other players in the energy political world as well. It's a very complicated world, particularly when you're dealing with comprehensive bills. This would be one of, you know, the biggest energy bills ever in Illinois. So,
and do we have a sense, Steve? Yeah, if that bill were to pass, what that would mean for consumers? You mentioned especially consumers outside of Chicago. How much that might mean a difference for energy bills?
Yeah, I mean, it would, you know, everybody's got their hand out. Everybody wants financial support for their programs or for their facilities. And there's only one source of money for all of that, and it's ratepayers. It's people who pay electric bills. That's businesses. That's households. So it's not just Dynegy and coal plants. It's not just Exelon and nuclear plants. It's environmental provisions that environmental groups and the renewable energy industry are pursuing that also would increase the bill surcharges people pay to support energy efficiency programs, for example. So you start getting into money that starts making a difference on people's electric bills. Now, how much downstate? It's really hard to tabulate all that right now because all this stuff isn't really very concrete yet.
Well, everyone's just talking about it, Steve. And you mentioned environmental groups. What are environmental groups throughout Illinois saying about this?
Environmental groups have been negotiating with ComEd and Exelon over both the nuclear stuff and then a bunch of stuff that ComEd wants to sort of change how we set the price of delivering electricity, and then fixes to the state's law that supports clean energy as well. So that's been going on for over a year. They've made a lot, you know, they've made progress from what I've heard. But the environmental groups are, you know, this coal provision is going to definitely split the environmental community if it becomes a serious part of all of this.
I wanted to ask you about nuclear power plants. We know that Exelon has been notifying utility authorities about shutting down the plant in the Quad Cities. This was already doing so regarding Clinton. What's going on with those power plants?
Yeah, both are on a course for shutdown, and without action in November veto session, I think Clinton is probably a goner. You could conceivably still save Quad Cities with action next spring, but yeah, there's definitely a time element to all of this.
So you think for the time element for the nuclear plants, I mean, or do you think that we're sort of on that course and it's not likely that will be reversed, or are you kind of paying attention to what will happen in the next couple of months?
Yeah, no, it's not. It won't be reversed unless there's legislation passed. I mean, they're not going to change their minds. They've applied with the various bodies that regulate all this stuff to do it, and so, you know, Exelon, I think, has at this point demonstrated they're serious about closing the plants if they don't get financial relief.
That's Steve Daniels joining us, as he has, to talk about utilities, electric, power, coal, and nuclear. He covers that for Crane Chicago Business. We tweeted out a link to Steve's story so you can see all the details of what we've been talking about. Steve, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The first Monday night football games of the NFL season were last night. Shortly before that, legendary Chicago Bears football coach was challenging the NFL to take more responsibility for concussion issues. We're joined now by Michael Puente, a reporter with WBEZ Chicago Public Media, who was at a luncheon that hosted a panel discussion on concussions yesterday, where Coach Ditka was weighing in on the issue. Michael, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thank you, Nyla.
This was a lunch about concussions. Who else was there? What was the goal of this luncheon?
Well, you had a number of panelists, attorneys, and other wife of a former football player. The goal of the discussion was to bring to light the issue of concussions and the health effects from that, talking about the issue of CTE, that's chronic traumatic encephalopathy. It's sort of a degenerate brain disease that over time, because of the number of concussions, could lead to serious health effects. So it was just really to, you know, bring attention to the issues that football players are facing because of concussions.
Were you or others there surprised by what Coach Ditka said yesterday?
Oh, absolutely. I think what Coach Ditka said was very surprising, and he even alluded to that it may not make him popular with the officials in the NFL in New York City. And you got to remember, Mike Ditka has been very loyal to the NFL. It's made him who he is today. But, you know, he even can't ignore what's been going on and seeing the health of friends that he played with, you know, deteriorate because of concussion. So, yes, his comments were very surprising.
Let's actually hear a little bit of what he had to say.
I know why we started Gridiron Grace is because guys were slipping through the cracks. Nobody was helping him. Nobody was listening to them. We created awareness is what we created. And we helped some people. We were not the answer. But it was not our responsibility either to be the answer. The responsibility falls on the National Football League. And it always will.
That's former Chicago Bears Hall of Fame coach Mike Ditka yesterday. WBEZ's Michael Puente is here telling us about that luncheon that he was at. There's a lot in there, Michael. Let's start with this Gridiron Greats. Is that Coach Ditka's organization? What was he talking about there?
Coach Ditka is part of that organization. It was actually started back in 2007 by NFL Hall of Fame lineman from the Green Bay Packers, Jerry Kramer. Jerry Kramer actually got his Super Bowl ring stolen, and he found that it was going to be auctioned off. So, you know, they raised $22,000 to get his ring back, but he donated that money, and that's how they found Gridiron Greats. And of course, Mike Ditka has been played a major role in Gridiron Greats. And basically, what it does, it's to help struggling former football players.
And then he said, this isn't, we've been doing this, I've been doing this, but this isn't really our responsibility to be doing this. The NFL should be doing this.
That's right. He says the reason they did it was because there was nobody else paying attention to these former players, so something has to be done. But he says, right, it wasn't their responsibility to do it. It was the NFL, but nobody was doing it. But now that a lot of this is coming to light, of course, there was a lawsuit of 5,000 former players who have sued the NFL because of their health problems. You know, a lot more attention is being played and a lot more pressure is being put on the NFL for them to start taking responsibility for the former players and for the players who are playing now.
Well, and Michael, I wonder what you think it means for having someone like Mike Ditka calling upon the NFL to take action.
Well, Nyla, we all know Mike Ditka is a powerful voice. He's legendary, and his voice is going to help. But remember, you know, the NFL is a multi-billion-dollar industry. It's the most popular sport in America. His voice is going to help, and it's going to help tremendously. But more pressure is going to need to be put on the NFL to do the right thing, to take responsibility. And I actually think that pressure is probably going to have to come from fans like me, who, you know, we are helping to make the NFL stay popular and rich. But that's, you know, the fans are the ones who are going to probably have to put that pressure on the NFL to start taking care of their players.
Well, and Michael, your point about fans also, I think, is it's not just support for the NFL, but you also think about support for people playing football and for children playing football. And I was really surprised to hear Coach Ditka yesterday. He said that he might not even encourage his own grandkids to play football. Let's hear exactly him in his own words.
But somebody asked me, what about my grandkids? I said, I'd probably put a golf club in their hand. Now, I'm not Not that I wouldn't want them to understand the thrill I had of playing the game or the challenges I had of trying to play the game. But I'm just saying, for long-term effects, I'd put off club in her hand.
Michael, I wonder what the mood was in the room in the luncheon when he said that, that you're thinking Mike Ditka is saying, maybe I don't want my grandkids to be playing football.
You know, it's not the first time he has said that. I've heard him say that before. But you're right. If you have somebody as great as Mike Ditka saying that, you know, he may not want his grandchildren playing football, I mean, that's a telltale sign. But you got to understand, I mean, football brings riches. It brings fame. You know, it's the glory. We've seen it yesterday during Monday Night Football. You know, players, it's still a very popular sport, and I don't think that's going to go away. But what can happen is just making the game safer. People say that one of the things people like about football is sort of the violence of the sport. I mean, the violence is part of it, but also it's just the athletic ability. And I think there can be a healthy medium on that, maybe making helmets safer, you know, fining players high amounts for those spearing, using their head as a sort of as a weapon. So a lot more can be done, but is it going to be enough to stop all these concussions? I don't know. But we got to remember, too, other sports, you can get concussions in those, too. So I'm not sure if banning football is also the answer.
Well, that's we heard Chicago Bears football coach Mike Ditka yesterday weighing in on all of this. It'll be interesting to see what happens as this season unfolds. I want to thank WBEZ Chicago Public Media reporter Michael Puente for joining us. Michael, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Nyla.
Coming up on the 21st, we'll be talking about Brexit with Woodrow Wilson fellow Michelle Egan, what that means 2 months on for Illinois and for the United States. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st. Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's been almost 3 months since the majority of voters in the UK chose to leave the European Union. We've seen some changes, including a credit downgrade and a new British Prime Minister, Theresa May. But in many ways, we're still waiting to find out what Brexit really means, not just in Europe, but here in the U.S. Michelle Egan's been following events in Europe. She's in Illinois this week for a lecture at the University of Illinois. Her latest book is titled Single Markets, Economic Integration in Europe and the United States. And she's in studio with me, Professor Egan. Welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, some current and former members of the government in London have said they're worried. The Prime Minister, others opposed to Brexit, might try to delay the withdrawal to the point that it actually never happens. At one point, I remember there was even a petition saying that the vote was so close that this should be done again. Is there any chance that Brexit won't happen?
I think there's been a sea change in London. Whitehall, which is our government bureaucracy, our Foreign and Commonwealth Office, they're planning. They're in Brexit mode. So you'll see a lot of agencies and government officials really working to make Brexit happen. The question is, when will we trigger it? When will we start it? And what kind of demands? But it's very clear to me that Theresa May is a very cautious politician. So she's weighing up all the options right now as Prime Minister before deciding.
And what has she said about the timeline?
The timeline, I think she's really thinking that it will not be triggered before 2017, the withdrawal process, but she then has a 2-year window to make that happen. And she faces the issue of German and French elections coming up, but also the fact is the European Commission, who will be her negotiator, and the European Parliament are actually going to be changing in 2019, right when that vote is needed to approve that deal.
And then is that why we're seeing many in Britain, including a number of former government officials, saying they want to see an exit much sooner?
Some of this is pressure coming also from the EU institutions. They're worried about the uncertainty. They're worried about the impact on markets, particularly in countries like Italy. But part of this is also, remember, this is a close vote, 52-48. So the 48ers are still saying that we don't like this decision. But definitely Brexit means Brexit is what she has said. And I think that she's going to have much more of an imprint on it than people are giving her credit for. Now they're starting to realize how tricky and complicated it is with millions of EU citizens in Britain and millions of British citizens in the rest of the EU. It's not going to be easy to wall off and close borders.
And of course, as you mentioned, alluded to this a little bit, we've seen enormous political turmoil about this within the UK. David Cameron actually on Monday saying he's going to step down as a member of parliament. Of course, he resigned as prime minister almost immediately in the aftermath of the vote. How do you think this political turmoil, this vote has affected, before we get to just economic, just the overall sense of stability within the UK?
Well, the other issue that a lot of people thought it was going to be a doomsday scenario. You heard a lot of economists talking about the economic impact, and there has been some of that, obviously, and even the Bank of England governor. But some of the Brexiteers, as they like to call themselves, have said it hasn't been as bad as you think. Now, you could turn around and argue and say that the British are not having seen the effects yet in the scientific or academic or agricultural communities because we're still part of the EU. We tend to forget that. We're still part of this legal obligation until we formally leave. But so from that point of view, I think it's very mixed. But it's very hard to know what the long-term impact. Probably the irony of this is that David Cameron has to bite the bullet and step down. But the irony of it, the party in disarray is actually the Labour Party. They've actually borne the brunt of Brexit.
I'm speaking with Michelle Egan. She's a fellow in the Global Europe Program with the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., where she's based. She also teaches in the School of International Service at American University. She's in Illinois for a lecture at the University of Illinois on Monday afternoon. And your work compares the EU, your most recent work, your most recent book, the EU and U.S. markets. I wonder what lessons you see from U.S. history in terms of what's playing out now in Britain and the EU.
That's a very, very tough question. One of the things I might say is that for Britain to withdraw from an economic unit, we've never seen that happen in the United States. And so one could argue that they're apples and oranges. It would almost be like Texas or Illinois deciding to have their own currency, deciding to not be part of the economic community here, deciding not to have cross-border trades and going on their own. That's very difficult. You know, Britain's a mid-sized Atlantic economy. So we don't even know what the impact will be. But I also think it's perhaps a question of political identity. You know, in the United States, in the United States in the 1860s, you started becoming the United States in the plural. And you have sort of a notion of political identity and symbols and so forth. People a lot of times in Europe, they feel they're British first or German first, but they also, some of them, particularly the young people, the educated people, also feel they have a European identity. I don't think we quite have that notion of a NAFTA identity in the United States.
Well, and I also think as your work makes a very interesting point that when the American states came together, we tend to look back on that or we look at how the EU came together and think of that as solely an economic decision. But actually, your work and your area of expertise shows that there's actually a lot more other layers that are societal and cultural that are involved rather than simply economic.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's probably the British difficulty with the EU, because we used to refer to it as a common market. And for us, it's always about been economic transactions, whereas a lot of other people in Europe, particularly French or Dutch or Germans, at various points in time have thought about this as more federal and are much more comfortable with a federal model and giving up some power to the center. So I think that's partly the difference. And I also think perhaps that, you know, this was a long struggle in the United States. You know, the single currency didn't come about automatically. So we created a network and integrated our market in the United States through a transcontinental railroad. This was not an easy process. And so, you know, we also had a common language here in the United States. And so 28 languages, 28 legal traditions, 28 political and economic cultures makes it, you know, collective action and a collective decision making very, very difficult.
Well, and when you think about the history of those individual 28 states within the EU, the longstanding history and sometimes the literal wars that have happened between different countries that are now part of the EU, I wonder how you see that also reflecting into the future of the EU. Now that we see Brexit, we think about a common market, but how much progress do you think there will be to be made towards having more common cultural and common historical and everything that you're saying that the U.S. had, you know, a little easier go of it, it sort of sounds like also?
It's going to be very difficult. I think you have a sort of generation of younger people who've traveled abroad, lived abroad, they've studied abroad. That's the kind of transnational, cosmopolitan sort of people in Europe. And then you have a lot of people who, you know, have worked and lived back home and are very much in their own nation state. So I think there's a generational divide and an educational divide between how European people feel. Having said that, you know, the legacy of Europe is really about peace, prosperity, and moving away from that nationalism that we saw so strongly in the, you know, 20th century. What we are concerned about, though, in Europe is the rise of ultranationalism, nationalist populist parties in many, many countries, which are targeting individual groups. They're blocking and raising borders. And there's a sense that, you know, a level of Europeanness, if you like, is diminishing as we're seeing the emergence of a much stronger nationalism than we've seen in many, many years, particularly, you know, not to single out any particular countries, but, you know, we've seen a surge of nationalist rhetoric. We saw some of it in Brexit,
mm-hmm,
in
certainly,
Britain,
right, with the British National Party.
We saw some of it also in Hungary and in Poland. So it's a phenomena that's going across Europe, you know, sort of an anti-immigrant, anti-foreigner, concern about national identity. It's very, very real.
Well, and some would say that's, you're seeing that play out here within the American election. We're seeing how much the Brexit vote has then sort of played out within the American political arena, particularly in this 2016 presidential election. I wonder how you see first of all, I'd love to talk about the economic, but first let's start with the political implications of Brexit on the U.S. political scene and particularly the presidential election.
Well, we did see Nigel Farage come here and speak, actually very strangely talking about withdrawal and secession. He's a very good, articulate speaker. He was in the Trump campaign and he was talking about, you know, you need your Brexit. What that means, I think, for them is very different in Britain. It's not about economic isolationism. It's not about protectionism. It's much more of getting your sovereignty back. And that's a sense that, you know, what does that mean in the United States, which is the global economy, the global hegemon, the global political leadership it provides. So it's a very unusual message. But a lot of it is also the concern that we've lost our own autonomy, perhaps. And that was the message I think he was articulating and playing out here. It's, you know, his message became somewhat more anti-immigration with some of the posters. So that's going to resonate also with some of the discourse going on in this election.
Well, I'm thinking of Nigel Farage and how much the talking points in Brexit were about jobs and how much you see a very similar message with Donald Trump here and how much of it is as opposed to societal or cultural economic and people feeling like this is the only way they feel like they would have an opportunity to work, whether we're talking about the UK leaving the European Union or American jobs here.
Well, the interesting two points I should say about the comparison is a lot of people, I was back home in Britain talking to people, you know, why did they vote? What was the driving force? And you went to a lot of small mining towns or coal mining towns, sort of a little bit like the deindustrialization happening here. And a lot of them were going back to a time when they were a part of a union, a time when they had security of jobs, a time when there was, you know, moms, dads, sons, brothers who all worked for the same. And that's been changing since the 70s. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them were sort of almost taking a reaction to sort of the Thatcherism era when they thought things had changed. And so you feel that same looking back to an earlier era. You're hearing a lot of that perhaps in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and other places. So that's a commonality. But I also think that, you know, Britain wasn't about closing our borders to trade. It was about openness and the global economy and the prospects sort of trading with the rest of the world. That was a different kind of message coming out, particularly from those who wanted to leave the EU.
That said, I wonder what you feel like the immediate economic implications are for the American economy. Certainly when we're thinking about Illinois and we think about the variety of multinational corporations that are based here, whether they're in agribusiness or in insurance or other areas, I wonder where you see the biggest immediate economic impact for the U.S.
Well, the interesting thing is the slight difference between what Congress and President Obama are saying. Some of them are saying, yes, right now we're going to have a U.S. deal with Britain, a trade deal. It's a very strange climate to be talking about trade deals in the United States, given the presidential election. But the economies are very intertwined. There's a lot of foreign direct investment. There's a lot of trade between Britain and the United States. What I think will be the issue for the United States, particularly for financial companies, hedge funds, and so forth, is will London, will the city still remain the center of the financial relationship and very important within the EU? And so for most of them, this is about financial services. What will Britain be post-Brexit? And if Britain doesn't get a good deal for its financial sector, will these companies move? Will they move to Ireland? Will they move to Frankfurt? Will they move to Paris? The others countries are saying, yes, please come. We're already seeing certain companies already indicate they're moving part of their operations already because they're worried that Britain will be shut out of that market.
Yeah, I'm thinking about that. I actually have a lot of family in England that works in the financial sector in London. So I know I've had a lot of conversations with them about that. How else do you think that do you feel that Brexit will have an impact on the U.S.?
I don't think it will have an impact in the foreign policy and security sphere. On the one hand, Britain is one of the strongest countries towards Russian sanctions against Russia because of Crimea. So there is concern a little bit about losing a British voice in that era and that. And Britain has also been interested in enlargement and has always, quite frankly, been a supporter of enlargement to Turkey. So there's a feeling that this will change the dynamics within the EU, which does have an impact on the United States. But if we actually remember, you know, Britain is also has a strong amount of money on its defense. It is a strong sort of security actor relative to other states in Europe. That's going to continue with the United States. There's going to be intelligence cooperation, intelligence sharing. Britain is still going to see itself as an important ally for the United States.
I know that EU leaders are meeting this week in Slovakia to figure out next steps for the union after the British withdrawal. What factors are they considering? We started this conversation with saying certainly within the EU, they want some sort of resolution and a path forward, almost more so than British leaders do.
Well, Theresa May is probably the most cautious politician I know, so she will not be pushed around. There was a lot of comments at the G20 that her picture and photograph, she was very much at the back. I think that's her style. I think that's her leadership style. So I was not worried about that. I think she's cognizant of the fact that she doesn't want to get this tied up with the British, with the German and French upcoming elections. She does not want to give any major voice to ultranationalists and other movements. She's aware of the destabilizing effects it will have. So they'll be concerned about that. I also think they've got a whole host of other issues on their plate with the humanitarian refugee crisis, with the Russian strong-arming in certain areas. And I think also the Eurozone crisis is going to reemerge, particularly coming out of Italy. So there's plenty of other crises on the table, despite the British happens to be the largest one right now.
Michelle Egan is a fellow with the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. She's in Illinois for a lecture at the European Union Center at the University of Illinois. She'll also be presented with the Neil Prize for Excellence in EU Studies for her most recent book, It's Single Markets, Economic Integration in Europe and the United States. Professor Egan, thanks for coming in. Thanks for chatting with us.
And thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st of Nyla Boodoo. Whether it's a row of corn Riley-titled fall lineup, working farms, or breathtaking images of falling water, photographer Larry Kamfer's love of Midwestern landscape shines through in the images of his latest book. It's called A Prairie State of Mind. It's the eighth book of photographs a Central Illinois-based photographer has published. It's just out. He's actually doing a signing this Thursday evening at his gallery in Champaign, and he's with us now in our studio. Larry, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks very much.
You wrote in the introduction to this, the preface to all of your photographs, that when you first started out, you felt like you maybe had to compensate for the pictures that you were taking of the Midwest and of landscapes. It seemed too simple. Is that an accurate description of where you were at originally?
Yeah, I had moved from Portland, Oregon, and where everything was real obvious and
dramatic.
It was sort of, I think I look back and I think I really wanted to romanticize it here because I didn't really see all the layers of the beauty at that point. So I did use soft focus and grain and, you know, high grain photographs. And if there was some garbage in the print, in the scene, I would take that out. I just wanted to make it look just perfect. And then as I went along, I started to really appreciate it is what it is. And, you know, and it's beautiful just the way it is. So I started, you can see that this has kind of evolved into a lot more sharp, colorful images of the Midwest.
Well, and as you think about that, as you think about these images that are of you traveling all across the Midwest, I wonder how you felt like that philosophy has changed now in this most recent work of yours. Do you really just think when you're coming across scenes or when you're out shooting, do you just sort of feel like I just need to be in the moment and capture that as opposed to I need to stage it or make sure?
Yeah, I've not staged things, but I've actually gone from being in the moment to what I consider now to look a little more in depth. So I know a lot more about the Midwest, you know, the ebbs and flows of the people and the natural cycles. And I think that plays a lot more than it used to. So instead of looking for just a composition, a focus point here and, you know, a foreground there, I kind of think about it in terms of, you know, the history or, you know, the fields have drain tiles here because this was swamp area. So so it's something to think about, you know, when you have when you see an element like a drain tile in the field. And another example would be the hay bales. You know, they've changed from rectangle to round. You know, why is that? It's a mechanization. And so I kind of look at things a little bit different and a little more in depth now than just superficially as a image.
Well, and there's one image in the book and it goes across two pages and you are in the middle. It's the shot of it's like you're in the middle of a sea of sunflowers and they just go on and on for, I mean, I just as far as the eye can see these sunflowers. So they have the up focus of the ones that are close to you in the background. Can you tell us where this was shot and do you remember this moment?
Yes. In fact, I may not always remember precisely where, but I always remember the images when I'm doing it. That is about 15 photographs put together.
Wow. Okay.
I'll do it. Basically, to get the range of image, to get the range of tone, the dynamic range, I'll take three or four, and then to make it a larger file size, I'll stitch together maybe on that image maybe five different pieces of it, so that as you enlarge it, it's very sharp. What I loved is that there was this foreground, the background, it did look like a sea. We don't have, you know, people love to go to the ocean or the mountains and look out. We have seas here, but they're a little more finite. You could see the end. We have sea of corn, sea of, you know, it's the same feeling of being on an edge, though.
And are you driving around? Are you looking for this? Or do you just sort of, are you spending, how do you come across something like this to make a photograph like this?
A lot of times I'll I'll go to an area that I want to pursue and do a little bit of background study, you know, on what that area is about. I love being an outsider looking in because I don't take things for granted, and I love to look at the history of a place or how the people deal with it. And then I'll go to that place when I think that the sky is going to be right. And then I go look for a composition in that place. So, you know, a little bit of background, go to a place, and then look for a composition that kind of exemplifies that particular location.
So there's more than 100 photographs in this book. Lots of couple, they're from all across the Midwest. How did you choose locations to shoot? Did you specifically choose locations for this book, or are these things that you've taken over time?
They're pieces that I've taken over time. So,
and as you've done that, how far have you gone? Have you sort of, and I'm not going to ask you where your favorite state is to photograph, because I know you're not, I'm going to sense that you're not going to have an answer for that. But I wonder if you can mention a couple places you've been that sort of kind of stand out to you in terms of different states across the Midwest.
Okay. I actually love near the Quad Cities, on either side, but on the other side, the Iowa side, you've got when the sun is very low, you've got these beautiful hills there. I mean, in central Illinois, we might call them mountains, but they're just these beautiful hills, and the sun makes this nice composition with lines, and I think that's really nice. I'm attracted to Starved Rock.
And it's interesting because as we're thinking about different states, there are different landscapes across the Midwest, right? Because we might tend to think, oh, everything's flat, but I guess you probably found that's not necessarily the case.
No, but I really do love the more flat. It for a couple of reasons. One, it's a challenge to try and get that subtlety. So I have to say Missouri is a little too hilly, and even Wisconsin's wonderful. But it's got, I like a little bit more of the flat. That's not to say that I don't enjoy going to the mountains and photographing.
Well, and in fact, we wanted to have you on last week, but you were out in California. We were told you were in the field.
Yes.
What were you doing out in California?
That was spectacular. It was in Napa Valley, the wine harvest, the grape harvest.
Okay.
And that's a whole nother thing. It was really, really great. I was really to show how it was being harvested, and everything was perfect. Of course, the weather was, you know, just right every day. And
well, and as you think about this, as you've traveled across the country, taking photographs of different regions, for you, do you think that for the Midwest, do you really feel like it is, as you've said, the prairie state of mind for you? What do you think are the different defining characteristics from what you've seen of the landscape of the Midwest?
Well, I think one of the things that strikes me most, I believe, is that now I've been here for, you know, 20, 30 or more years, and there's a solidness of repetition. You know, repetition of the corn, the cycles, you know, you get this time of year is fall, it's beautiful. All of a sudden, the corn turns this beautiful golden brown, that there's this, you know, the landscape is really nice. Everything sort of stops and it's peaceful. And then suddenly you see the landscape you see the horizon line because the corn because everything is harvested. And then there's this white embossed landscape. So,
I wonder also if you see a lot of geometry. There's certainly a lot of the images in here where there are just so many interesting patterns and shapes to what you have seen in landscapes of fields, whether that's lines of crops or fields themselves. Is there sort of very neatly delineated? Do you think that's something you see most often here in the Midwest?
I do. It could be, you could have it elsewhere with the hills and the vineyards, you know, have these lines. But I love to see the black soil, the really deep black soil with the little furrows and peaks and valleys and really highlight that.
And your most previous book, in 2014, you released a book. It was called Chicagoscapes. Mm-hmm. That was a joint project with your wife, right? And she's from Chicago?
Originally, yes.
Originally. I wonder, how do you approach shooting something like when you're in the city, you're trying to do Mag Mile, anywhere on Michigan Avenue or a neighborhood street like Devon, versus is it different when you're photographing out in a field and most of the images here, which really, actually, there's no people in any of these as I'm thinking about it.
It's a little, there's a little different adrenaline flow there. I'm working probably a little quicker, but in order to
in a city.
Right, right. It actually digital when in 2003 when I went digital, it enabled me to really go into the city to photograph what I've always kind of enjoyed seeing, textural street corners and people interacting, and I really love that. So I it's a little different. It's just a lot more energetic that way.
And one of the things that was really amusing me was the titles of your photos. I mentioned Fall Lineup, which is the stacks of corn. Mm-hmm. There's this picture of falling water where you capture the water, and it's called Stream of Consciousness. Mm-hmm. How do you come up with those? Do they just come to you in the moment?
No, it takes a little bit of time. What I do is I look at the photograph, and I try and remember what I was thinking at the time. And it's kind of this long process, and I work with my staff too, and come up with some of them. It's really a...
You mentioned that going digital, that was maybe a little longer than 10 years ago. And when we're thinking about this picture we were talking about with the sunflowers, how many you stitched together, how do you think the techniques of photo technology have changed what you do?
It really became a lot more exciting, I think, with digital. Once digital got to be of the same quality, if not better, there are so many more possibilities. You're truly limited by your imagination. However, I don't, unless I specifically say an image is interpreted, I don't change things. I'm able to take them differently, like with a gigapan where I could do 150 photographs in one shot and stitch those together, or high dynamic range where I get the lights and the darks and everything. But I don't put in a fake blue sky, or, I've realized that a lot of what I feel like I do best is to show really what it's like, and people can feel that this is my front porch.
Well, and there's this remarkable one in here, and you entitled it Rose-Colored Glasses, mm-hmm. and it's this stunning purple or pink-hued mm-hmm. Shot of clouds coming across a field with water. And you didn't shoot this with a filter. There's no filter.
No,
this is actually
no.
what the sky looked like. And I mean, that's the thing that I love the most about the landscape here is how you can see storms coming mm-hmm. across. I mean, when you're shooting weather or storms, is that a more exciting or more difficult thing?
It is more exciting. I love the skies we have here. That's everyone really, I think, sees that, but it doesn't necessarily register on a moment to moment. From moment to moment, I have the advantage of taking a moment in time and highlighting that in two dimensions. So, that particular image, the sun just before it sets, it'll light up the bottom of a cloud bank.
Larry, do you have an audience in mind when you take a picture? And I'm thinking, especially maybe not when you take a picture, but as you're putting together everything for A Prairie State of Mind, is this for people from the Midwest, or for people who you want to see, to introduce them to parts of the Midwest they haven't necessarily seen?
I think it's for the people from the Midwest. However, if you want to brag about how beautiful it is here, this might be something where you can show that it really is beautiful. You get people from, not to pick on California or Oregon, but
Napa. Go ahead, pick on Napa.
There you
That's
go.
Fine.
that come in and or even that come from the city up north, and they're driving down. And they say, "There's nothing here." Well, there's so much here. It's magnificent. I call it the magnificence of the everyday. It's the beauty right at your feet. It's really just having to look at it and contemplate it.
Larry Kimfer is talking about his latest book. It's a compilation of his photographs. It's called A Prairie State of Mind. He'll be doing a book signing this Thursday evening at his gallery, the Larry Kimfer Gallery in Champaign. We'll tweet out all the details to that and have it up on our site. Larry, thank you so much for being with us.
Certainly my pleasure.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about a recent study in Chicago that shows a little financial help in desperate times can actually prevent people from becoming homeless. So stay tuned for that. As always, you can go to our website, www.21stshow.org, for details on how to reach us, information about past shows, and what we've talked about today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.